You know, we see so many builders, innovators here that are taking things on. And I think about so many of the great nonprofits that are out there that are taking on these challenges, companies that are trying to take on this generous approach. For the people here and out there who are listening, how can they take this ethos into their companies? I've seen entrepreneurs like Adam Nash, who's founder of Daffy, who's trying to create his whole company premise around how to donate money more easily. You see Adam's, the shoes that you're wearing is another example you talk about. There's so many great examples of these things. For the entrepreneurs and the builders, how do they instill a generous mindset into the values of their company?
So this is the beautiful thing, that in this connected age, a company, I think, would be crazy not to try to adopt a generosity strategy. The stuff that TED did in terms of giving away its content, giving away its brand, that was actually essential to TED's success. If TED had been not a nonprofit but a business, that would have been the smart strategy, because it is that that made TED known and made things happen and work. In this connected age, the rules around what you hold on to and what you give away have changed. Because it is relatively easy to give away amazing things to an infinite number of people at zero cost, hello, why wouldn't you adopt a generosity strategy? And so I think any company or any group of employees in a company could gather for half a day to brainstorm the following question. What is the biggest, best, craziest thing we could give away that we have? What is it? And there is a very high chance that that giving away that thing could transform that organization's, that company's future. Because if it's done with audacity, if it's done with creativity, if it's done with boldness, who knows what happens from it? So a typical thing is just company to start with, you know, your knowledge base. What do you know that the world could benefit from? Are you sure in this connected age, it's right for you to hold that inside a vault, as opposed to giving it away and picking up the reputation that will come from that? I think every big company could consider putting on a free online learning course about the knowledge that they uniquely have, whether it's a manufacturing process or a coding process.
Since I picked on Elon earlier, the fact that Tesla gave away their patents.
Yeah, you know, with some restrictions, you don't do it stupidly. But what he said about the reason for doing that was so that he could recruit great engineers. This is exactly the point. He said, people do not want to work for a company. They want to work for a cause. And in this age, in this knowledge age, where all of the value that is created comes from the minds of brilliant people, they want to work for companies that are doing something that matters.
Well, for me personally, I think of the open source movement and how central that has been to Silicon Valley and in the ecosystem, where we give software away, we give our time away to engineer a better solution that we can all benefit from.
The power of open source is incredible. The power of something like Wikipedia is incredible. I mean, it's part of the wallpaper now, but I mean, it is an incredible thing that the volunteered time of tens of thousands of people has created an incredible public good. I just think that there is much more of that that could happen.
I think one of the things that also comes through reading the book, but also reading through the examples, is there has to be a degree of authenticity to that generosity. If it's just window dressing for this, it doesn't really work. And you almost talk about this, of what makes a good TED talk versus something that doesn't make the cut.
Yeah, I definitely think that the good, best TED talk starts with generosity. If someone comes on stage with intention to promote themselves or their company, it's a bust. If they come onto stage with intention to be generous, to share something that's buzzing around in their brain with many other people, that's a beautiful thing. But the whole question around intention is really interesting. Because one of the things that is getting in our way is that we are so quick to judge people if we can discover anything about their motivation that we think is suspect. I think generosity has always been suspect. It's always been, to some extent, selfish. Give and you shall receive. That's suspect. Give and your reward shall be in heaven. Okay, that's selfish. Give because it feels good for your conscience. I think we actually have to embrace, especially in this connected age, what I call imperfect generosity, Stop looking for the bad in people's intent. Look for the good. Mm-hmm. If almost every act of generosity in this connected age is going to have mixed motives, because if you're generous, it will boost your reputation. We're connected, and reputation really matters. So, of course, that may be part of the motivation. That should be celebrated, not condemned, because we want to give people every reason they can to be generous. So embrace imperfect generosity. So, like, if it's completely cynical, sure, forget that. But almost always, people want to do something for the public good, and they're delighted with the fact that it may also generate, in this connected era, surprising effects that come back to benefit them in some way. That's beautiful. Embrace it. Right. That's how it should be.
Well, before we get to these questions that are coming in are fantastic. I think you have another book here, just looking at these. I'd love for you to talk about something that I think is so special, because I've been so fortunate to see the firsthand impact of this, is the Audacious Prize. Hmm. And so I'd love for you to tell the audience a little bit about the Audacious Prize and how they might be able to take it with them and enact it in their own lives.
Okay. It used to be the TED Prize. It's now the Audacious Project. So this came from an observation of just how miserable it is if you're leading a nonprofit to raise money. I view people running some of the world's best nonprofits as true global heroes. You know, they're sacrificing the money they could make for a cause that's bigger than them. And what do we do as a world to thank them for that? We make them spend 50 to 80% of their time trying to raise money. It is shocking. It's so broken. Why would we do that? And from the donor's point of view, there is something broken as well, in that so often the nonprofit projects that are presented to them, because they come at the end of 10 wearying meetings, they come over as kind of boring, and it's like, please, will you fund our overhead for the next 12 months? That's not interesting. So how can you break that? And so the Audacious Project was an attempt to break that cycle and to say, first of all, to the nonprofit heroes, actually, what is your biggest dream? If money was no object, make the hair stand up on the back of my neck with something bold. When you ask that question, what you get back is incredible. There are teams out there that can change the world in the most astonishing ways. So you take the best of those, you help try and distill them into a workable, credible, actionable 3 or 5 year plan. And then you bring those plans to a group of donors at one time, say 20 or 25 of them at one time. And you say, okay, we've got 2 days together. We're going to look at this in detail. You're going to look at the investment document. You're going to look at the video of the person. And at the end of the 2 days, we're going to decide which of these we're going to fund or not. After we've left here, it's back to business as normal. Nothing will happen. So make the decision now or don't. And what started happening is that this works. At the end of 2 days, people are gathered around and someone will say, I'm persuaded. I would like to support this. Infectious generosity in a nutshell. Ping, ping, ping. I'm in, I'm in, I'm in, I'm in. In 2 minutes, you can get a commitment for $100 million. We're doing this now for 5 or 6 years. This thing works. It's absolutely freaking thrilling. The donors themselves are recruiting their friends to come and be part of it. Come and have the most expensive weekend of your life and cry. How great is that?
That's going to be great on a brochure.
It's great. It's great. And so in the last one we did in February, we raised just over $1 billion for 10 projects. I mean, it was just amazing to see. And there's more that can happen here. So we can break this awful cycle and allow great projects. So my suggestion in the book was that this can be done at a community level. Gather a group of friends together. You may collectively not have enough money to build the local skate park that someone wants to put in, or the library, or the park, or the soup kitchen. But you might know people in the community who are doing amazing things. So find the best 5 of them and ask them to dream their biggest dream. What really could you do for our community? And then go and try to find the best local business leaders or philanthropists, the people who've made it, and tell them, we're going to give you an opportunity you've never done before. You can be a local hero. We're going to present you amazing projects that you will have a chance to fund. I think there's a way of doing this that could transform the dynamics that happen in communities, that could bring rich and poor together, if you like, and could create amazing things because people want to do this. And it's just about breaking out of the cycle so that people can do it at one time with visibility of each other. Generosity is infectious. We're human beings, we're a social species. In the right context, magic can happen.
Fantastic. A number of questions here around this year in particular. It's an election here in the United States. People are faced with incredible cynicism. How do we fight it?
It's really, really hard. I think I buy the theory that the extreme voices that we hear do not represent mainstream opinion, that just because of the dynamics we talked about, 5 or 10% of people have shaped the conversation. And actually, a lot of people are crying out for a different way of framing things. I think we need bridges, people who are willing to be courageous and to stand up and say, wait a sec. Not everything the other side is saying is evil. Some of it I hate, but there is some sanity in there. Let's change the dynamic here. But look, I think it's extraordinarily hard to do this, and I think it's going to take a lot of people to fight to do it. We're wrestling right now at TED with what role we can play. We're determined to try to play a bit better of a bridging role. And for example, bring people together and say, okay, before you have your debate, flip sides. Can you articulate what you think this person really cares about and why? Can we change the dynamic of the conversation? I hope there's a way to do it. I really do, because so much hangs on that.
Yeah. Another train of thought here that is in the questions of how do you instill generosity in your kids?
We don't need to instill it in our kids. It's in them. Humans are fundamentally generous. And if you look at the response to the next generation of someone like Mr. Beast on YouTube, I mean, they love him. You know, you gave 1,000 people their sight. You are my hero. This is amazing. You know, like the instinct is to cheer it on. And there's all kinds of social experiments that show how generous kids ought to be. I just think it's visibility. It's visibility. I was speaking with someone today whose 9-year-old daughter had just seen an example of a young girl who lacked something and wanted to give her whole pocket money to that girl. If you give kids a chance to see need, they will respond. So that's not a problem.
Is there a way that generosity can counteract misinformation and disinformation?
Yeah, I absolutely think so. I mean, I think anyone who spends their time looking to do that online is being generous. It's a gift of time. I mentioned the community notes feature on X, and you know, the people doing that, everyone volunteering for Wikipedia, like there are so many people who actually are spending time doing that. I think there's a lot more that we could do. I actually think there's opportunity for a nonprofit to embark on this in a big way online, and almost Wikipedia on steroids. But it's an important act of generosity, just any time you see it, to be willing to highlight it in a respectful way.
Do you have advice for people how to do that? Because we're in this age of if you try to call out something, sometimes suddenly you're the target, yes. Particularly people of color, women, or other minorities.
I really think it's hard. I think it's hard. I think it takes courage. Part of me sees some signs that the pendulum is swinging a bit back. Like I think, I don't know about you, I think people are so sick of what we've become and how we are thinking of each other. It's not who we are. Humans are capable of more than this. So the Solzhenitsyn line is really important. You know, the line between good and evil does not run between countries and identity groups and classes. It runs through every human heart. If we are careful and thoughtful and reflective about it, we can find ways to nurture each other to be our better selves instead of our worst selves.
One of the things that I think you also talk about in the book as a follow-on to this is how do you decide making your anonymous versus public in your generosity? And sometimes that can also be a lightning rod on things. And so what's the advice for us as right. those that are trying to do this?
So the traditional advice was always be anonymous, because otherwise clearly your motives are mixed and problematic. So you must be anonymous. I think in the connected area, that has become bad advice. I think it's possible we can stay anonymous, but the story of generosity must be told. We're in an existential battle here in how we as humans think of each other. Every story of humans doing something for other people needs to spread. Told the right way, that story will spread. If someone else can tell your story, that's beautiful. If not, find a way to tell it. It doesn't have to be boastful. And the way you make it not boastful is to fully recognize that everything that you do that allows you to be generous comes from serendipity, comes from privilege, comes from things that we have had. And so that's true for everything. There's nothing to boast about, but what there is things to celebrate and to share and to say, you know what, I tried this, it was amazing, it worked, people liked it, look what happened as a result. So I think that's the mode that we have to get in. And I think it makes a big difference if we all give ourselves permission to go into this mode. Stop dissing people for telling a story, for not being anonymous. Because if done the right way, that is the most beautiful thing. And otherwise, we're going to talk ourselves down and destroy ourselves. The stories we tell about ourselves shape who we are. We are telling stories right now of a dark and vengeful and dangerous species. And that shapes who we are. We become that. We've got to stop that and find a way of telling a different story of ourselves.
I always think of it as if, you know, in the Voyager spacecraft, what viral video should we put on there? And it should be like, you know, the guy who walks into the river to save a dog. And there's like all these videos that are really feel good. And one of the things you talk about is, you know, I think of it as a filter bubble. And it's like, well, why not have a filter bubble, a little bit more of generosity in these feel good videos? And so I thought that was a really clever sort of prod for me of like, am I following things that are taking me down or following things that are giving me a little bit of boost to make myself better and be a better person?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, every other part of our lives, we do this. We build these life hacks. You know, how do you persuade yourself to get up at a specific time or to, you know, to work out or to manage your diet? All of these things, you know, we've figured out life hacks, which is basically, this is your reflective self figuring out how to manage your lizard brain. In the realm of generosity, it's really important we do this. We figure out how to nurture the parts of ourselves that make us ready to do that. Gratitude is the number one thing. So I'll tell you a story. I woke up yesterday feeling so blue about a couple of things that happened. I just felt really disappointed and stressed. And I went swimming, and I swam 30 lengths at the hotel I was in. Every length, I thought about one other thing to be grateful for. And I came out of that pool aglow. Like, it's so simple. When you stop and think, there's the obvious things. You know, I love my kids. I love my friends. That's great. You know, but then you go on from there. You know, how great is it that I've got work that's actually meaningful? How great is it that I live in a room where there's electrical sockets all around the wall that I can plug devices into that can heat my body or cool my body or clean the damn room or clean the dishes. That's amazing. I'm happy to be alive now. This is an amazing time to be alive.
This is like gratitude journal on super steroids.
Just the fact that we can open our eyes and look around, and every moment you look around, you are seeing something different. You are having a unique visual experience that no one else in the history of the universe has ever had. And the faces that you see, there is an incredible story behind each of those faces. It is an amazing thing to be alive. And it's so easy for us to forget that. And then bad things happen. It's actually just starting that gratitude journey. Magic will follow from that.
I love that. I want to ask you about this one because this one really, I want to give voice to this because it's, I think one we often think of generosity is only dollars.
Yes.
And so the question is, if I make a generous charitable contribution, I receive a tax deduction. If I give my time, which is vastly more valuable, I receive no such donation. That doesn't affect me, but it might others. How can we change the infrastructure to support generosity of time and service? And how should we think about the dimensions of generosity?
I mean, you could definitely picture a world where the heroes of the world, like parents who look after kids, you know, especially parents who look after kids that need special care or something like that. That is heroic. They give their time. They're not rewarded. A fair society would reward them, and it's an important piece of generosity. But I also think generosity carries with it its own reward anyway. You know, there are just so many different ways other than money to be generous that are worth thinking about. We've spoken about some of them, of just giving attention and sharing knowledge and connections. There's also just the gift of creativity, of enchantment. The fact that one creative mind can enchant thousands of people in the era we're in, that is so beautiful. And hopefully someone does that, they get recognition back and so forth. But that's a beautiful thing. Hospitality, I think, is a beautiful act of generosity that can lead to so many other things happening. I think we could structure society more fairly, but also that gift of time probably brings with it its own joy.
In the remaining few minutes we have left, I'd love for you to talk about this. You talk about a pledge in the book. Mm. And I'd love for you to share what that pledge is. And really, it's an interesting one of where it comes from, like from a historical almost, right. Well, why don't you share it with us?
Sure. So for me, this started actually from a point of view of guilt. Again, grew up religious, heard this guy at church talking about his own generosity, looking after refugees and how he'd come home exhausted. But before he went to sleep, he would remember that there was a child suffering more than he was. And so he couldn't sleep. He'd have to work on. And I was so depressed by that. It was like, it's impossible to lead a good life. Life is going to be hell. If you want to be a moral person, you will be miserable your whole life. And, you know, Peter Singer has these powerful arguments how there is no moral difference between the child you see drowning outside your door and the pool across, you know, the way, versus a child suffering on the other side of the world who you could do something for. So what could we do about that? And so I started to think about, look, you can't have moral rules that people won't sign up for. Moral rules have to be realistic about who humans are and what we are capable of. So that's one thought. Could we come to a collective pledge that people could agree on, that if you met that standard, that was okay, you didn't have to go on stressing yourself? This was almost the start point. And what I looked at was, you know, religions arguably have wrestled with this for hundreds of years. They have come up with rules, which are, I think, a form of messy compromise between what is reasonable to expect of their followers and what morality demands. And so Judaism and Christianity have this tithing, 10% of your income you should give. Islam has a different but related thing, which is 2.5% of your net worth you should give. And so the first question I said was, okay, I'm not a religious person, but don't I aspire to have moral standards that are at least as high as the religions? Don't we? Mm-hmm. I think we do. So what would happen if we had a pledge that was actually the higher of 10% of income or 2.5% of net worth? Now, view that as an aspirational pledge for people who have got to a certain stage in life where they've paid off their debt, they're kind of they're comfortable, they can afford to have these thoughts. What could that pledge achieve? So I did some research. I tracked down this incredible woman, Natalie Cargill, who has a thing called Longview Philanthropy. She did the research on this. This pledge, if it was out there widely among the wealthier people in the world, would raise in total actually $10 trillion annually. It's about 10x.
Annually, 10 trillion annually.
Annually, about 10x of what we're giving away. I said, well, okay, not everyone's going to do this. What if a third of the people did that? What could you do philanthropically with $3.5 trillion annually? So this is what she figured out. She looked at every big problem that humankind faces and basically did the math and argued that we can solve every single one of those problems for $3.5 trillion of philanthropy a year. So you can debate her actual suggestions and so forth endlessly, but assume for a minute that that is true, that at $3.5 trillion of philanthropy, at that point, you don't need more philanthropy. The bottleneck to making change is more about execution. Then, wait a sec, this pledge would actually do the trick. The ancient religions got their numbers right, that we are wealthy enough. Humankind, if they made that pledge, we could actually address all of the problems we face. So I find that, yes, it's daunting. It's a lot of money. Many people are completely daunted by that. But I'm convinced that collectively we could aim to step up to that. And if we did, it would be enough. We could actually get over what I fear stops a lot of people even beginning a generosity journey, which is the fear that you're opening yourself up to endless obligation. And that is no fun at all. You don't have to. If we could just agree on that pledge, and then you have this thrilling, thrilling, thrilling project of how to spend this money in ways that will be utterly amazing and make us dream of a beautiful future where we are planting a trillion trees, when we are dealing with animal cruelty, we are dealing with global poverty and inequality. You pick your issue that you care about, climate change. She's convincing that most of the things that we could do can be done with this money. You know, it's basically leveraging government in this case and companies and so forth. But it's a completely thrilling agenda. And so anyway, that's where I've ended up is there's a chapter called The Pledge That Could Change Everything. I encourage people to go. There's a website, givingwhatwecan.org, has for years been urging people to give 10% of income. They've agreed now, they've added in this wealth pledge as an addition possibility that you can sign up for. My wife and I have signed up to do this now. Hire of those two. Go and do it and tell friends to do it. Because if we do this, that is our financial obligations taken care of. And then something else magical happens. And I'm sorry I'm going on. Something else magical happens, which is that you are forced to shift your financial giving to being more strategic. Instead of right now, someone, a friend or someone, we were moved and we thought, oh God, I better write a check for that. It's not effective. Plan your financial giving. Look for the organizations that are effective. There is an order of magnitude plus difference in effectiveness that can happen if you're thoughtful. So just by making a pledge, even if it's 1% of your income, it will shift you to strategic mindset. I think that's a powerful thing too.
It's an incredibly powerful idea. Just before we leave, how do people find out more? Because you've created actually a remarkable set of assets. What's the website that people should go to?
The website is infectiousgenerosity.org. One thing you'll find there, as well as, you know, ways of buying the book from your favorite bookseller, whatever, there's an AI there, an AI agent called Tig, the infectious generosity guru. Tig is great fun to play with. It helps you brainstorm what you can do given your skill set and your passions and your interests. It's given already me lots of ideas, including the idea I went out on social media with today. One woman who played with it said it had changed her life. So play with that. It's fun. AI can do good things.
On that note, I want to thank the audience for being generous with your time to be here, to come to the Commonwealth Club. Chris, I want to thank you for writing this book, and I encourage all of you to pick up a copy of the book made possible here by the Long Now Foundation and the Broad family. Thank you so much, and appreciate you being here at the club. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, DJ.
Thank you for listening to another Commonwealth Club radio show featuring Chris Anderson in conversation with DJ Patil. I'm Gloria Duffy, co-president and co-CEO of the club, now celebrating its 121st year. Join us again next week to hear our big annual economic forecast. Until then, you can learn more about us and our events at commonwealthclub.org. Find thousands of our programs on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and YouTube. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us in person at Commonwealth Club World Affairs of California.
Jazzy 93.7 is KJZY, Sebastopol.
Hey there, and welcome to the Dave Koz Radio Show for this weekend. That would be me, Dave, your humble host. And great to be here, as always. Thanks so much for being here this weekend. All right, settle in for the next couple of hours for some great music, as always, and to catch up with one hugely busy artist. Between his solo career, his teaching, his work with the Sax Pack, I'm getting tired just saying all of that, let alone doing it. Between all of that, we've managed to grab some time with saxophonist Steve Cole, and he'll tell us what's up.